It is Monday, September the 18th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, possibly another attempt at a Palestinian national unity government.
This one seems different in that Hamas is more or less putting all its chips on the table from the beginning.
More strong words from the U.S. for North Korea.
The intention is to send a strong message not only to North Korea, but North Korea's patron states, China and secondarily Russia.
Also ahead, more tropical activity and the music of Janis Joplin. Hello everyone, I'm Steve Norman. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah movement has welcomed a pledge by its Hamas rival to accept key conditions for ending a decade-old Palestinian political and territorial split, but said it wants to see vows implemented before making the next move. Repeated attempts at reconciliation have failed since the militant Hamas drove forces loyal to Abbas from the Gaza Strip in 2007, a year after defeating Fatah in the parliamentary elections. The takeover led to rival governments, with Hamas controlling Gaza and Abbas in charge of autonomous enclaves in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Randolph-Macon College Middle East scholar Michael Fishbach if the pledge from Hamas is significant.
Very significant, and if it actually happens, it would be extremely significant. Ever since the Palestinian elections for the parliament or the legislative council in 2006, Hamas and the ruling Fatah party, which has dominated Palestinian politics and certainly both the Palestine Liberation Organization and now the Palestinian Authority, that conflict has crippled the Palestinian body politic and has certainly made peace negotiations and a number of other things very, very complicated. So if indeed this leads to a true national unity government, and Hamas essentially dissolving its own separate administration in Gaza, it would be a major development.
But this has been tried before.
It has. What is interesting, though, is Hamas is saying now at the outset that it is willing to essentially relinquish power. I mean, that's essentially what they're saying. And I think that's what's significant in this instance. So, again, it remains to see, as you said, it's been tried before. National unity agreements have been arranged before. But this one seems different in that Hamas is more or less putting all its chips on the table from the beginning.
Is this good news for Israel?
No, actually. There are many, I happen to share that view, that think that the government of Israel under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is not really interested in any serious peace talks with the Palestinians, and the fact that Hamas has been part of the government, or at least controls Gaza, has been a way to avoid making any kind of forward movement. On the other hand, if Hamas does join with Fatah, that would hand him an even greater reason to resist future involvement in the peace process by saying, well, I can't deal with any kind of Palestinian government that includes Hamas. So on the one hand, it's not good news in that it could signal, as Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas is getting ready to go to the UN shortly, it could signal the fact that the Palestinians and their Arab allies are indeed positioning themselves for a return to talks, which I don't think he's really interested in. But like I said, it could provide him an out in the sense that if Hamas does join the government in a unity government, he can say, well, I'm not going to have any peace talks with anybody that includes Hamas.
Does it reduce the security threat to Israel?
Israel has always been in a position to really control security. Hamas, at best in the past 10 years, and some other factions have been able to launch rockets, but we haven't really seen that in recent years. So I don't think that in terms of security threat from Hamas, this is going to make a big difference to Israel one way or the other. It certainly has other things it's concerned with, such as the Islamic State group and Iran and what's going on in Syria. So I'm not sure that, as far as security goes, that this is nearly as important to Israel one way or the other as other threats that it faces.
Hamas has been weakened by an Israeli and Egyptian blockade, three wars with Israel, international isolation, its economy in tatters. Is that the reason why it's doing this?
I submit that it is. I have not seen press reports or inside stories about this that have suggested there's something else going on, although one can never put that out of the way, whether Hamas would, as far as some deal with Egypt in terms of allowing more trade in, would Hamas do something as far as helping the Egyptians fight Islamic radicalism in Sinai, although I don't know what they could do about that. But I think the main thing is that Gaza within 15 years will have no fresh water at all. Its economy is, as you said, terrible. It's completely blockaded. The Palestinian Authority has been holding back salaries for employees. Really, its only friend is Egypt, and Egypt is headed by Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who's a sworn enemy of the Muslim Brotherhood, out of which Hamas moved. So I think, yes, I think it's essentially in a place where the population of Gaza simply has, its humanitarian needs has really trumped any kind of Hamas political play here. I think that's basically the reason, yes.
Is this also a bid to improve relations with Cairo?
Well, undoubtedly it is. Now, like I said, that's always been complicated because when Mohamed Morsi was the president of Egypt, of course, he came out of the Muslim Brotherhood, and Hamas emerged out of the Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood, and so that was a great period for Hamas in terms of positive relations with Egypt. So I think that Hamas is quite aware that that al-Sisi is no particular friend of Hamas, but that in the end, with the United States, particularly in the Trump administration, looking elsewhere in the Middle East, that that really, you know, banking on Egypt and good relations with Egypt is a smart play on their part.
That's Dr. Michael Fishbach. He is a Middle East scholar at Randolph-Macon College. He's also author of many books on the Middle East, including his latest, Palestine as a Country of Color, Race, Identity, and the Arab-Israeli Conflict in America, 1964-82, being published by Stanford University Press. He was speaking with my colleague, Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. On Sunday, President Trump mocked North Korean leader Kim Jong-un by referring to him as Rocket Man, while White House advisors said Pyongyang would face destruction unless it shelves its nuclear and missile programs. UN Security Council has voted twice in recent weeks to tighten economic sanctions on North Korea, including targeting shipments of oil and other fuels used in missile testing. Mr. Trump's UN ambassador, Nikki Haley, told CNN on Sunday that North Korea is starting to feel the pinch. She also said the Security Council might have exhausted all of its options in dealing with Pyongyang. We asked Tufts University Korea and East Asian scholar Sung-Yun Lee for his read on Haley's comments.
The intention is to send a strong message not only to North Korea, but North Korea's patron states, China and secondarily Russia, that the U.S. now is seriously considering military strikes, not right away, but in due course. The U.S. is trying to put more pressure on China to sever its financial ties and its support for North Korean entities that go on proliferating and that are engaged in other illicit activities. Technically, at the U.N., there's not all that much that the Security Council can do. we know, we expect more nuclear tests and missile tests, and the Security Council will respond, as it has over the past decades, with tougher sanctions, measures on paper. But, you know, the crux of the problem always is enforcement. If the member states don't enforce these sanctions, the toughest sanctions on paper have little meaning. So I don't think we should interpret Ambassador Haley's comments as any sign that the U.S. is seriously considering military strike anytime soon. There's been no ultimatum, no deadline set for North Korea's behavior.
But Ambassador Haley said she's prepared to move on from diplomatic pressure on North Korea and hand the matter over to the U.S. Defense Chief, Jim Mattis.
Sure, but in fact, you know, the U.S. Security, the lives of protecting the lives of millions, tens of millions of Americans, that is not on the line yet. Military response will come when that becomes a looming question, when there is clear and imminent danger of a North Korean nuclear strike. Then the military option becomes more than an option, it becomes an imperative. Diplomats, of course, don't like to say that we've run out of diplomatic options. There's a cliche in the field, you know, diplomats don't take no for an answer. So in a way, Ambassador Haley's comment reflects her own frustration and the frustration on the part of the U.S. government that, you know, North Korea has been on this bluster barrage all throughout this year. And now with the U.N. General Assembly meetings among heads of states of the world to begin this week in New York, I think Ambassador Haley is trying to send signals to Beijing, to Moscow, and other countries to get them on board to enforce sanctions.
Soon-Yung Lee also said he would not read much into what sounds like harsh comments from U.S. officials regarding North Korea. He said at the same time the U.S. might sound like an aggressor, not like Pyongyang, and this would not play well with world public opinion. The Tufts University Korean East Asian scholar also said this could be made more interesting if North Korea announces at this week's opening of the United Nations General Assembly that it's willing to return to the negotiating table regarding its nuclear and missile programs. VOA's Lori London joins us now for what's being said on social media about North Korea and what President Trump has been saying.
Well, social media has been buzzing all day over a series of Sunday morning tweets by President Trump. And as you mentioned, Steve, Trump had something to say about the leader of North Korea. In a tweet, he says, quote, "I spoke with President Moon of South Korea last night, asked him how Rocket Man is doing. Long gas lines forming in North Korea, too bad." Now, for those of you who don't know the phrase, it's the name of an Elton John song, and of course, it's getting lots of reaction on social media. His supporters think it's absolutely great, and lots of them are commenting. They're tweeting that he is the king of nicknames, and they're absolutely loving it. They're finding it very hilarious. But not everyone is laughing. One person on Twitter said, "Oh, great, Trump taunts a paranoid dictator who wants to blow us up." Another person writes, "If at real Donald Trump referred to Kim Jong-un as Rocket Man, then does that make Donald Trump Tiny Dancer?" Referring to another Elton John tune. But this wasn't the only controversial tweet in a series on Sunday morning from the president. He took another swing at his former rival Hillary Clinton in the latest sign that his campaign fury hasn't ended. He retweeted a mock video that shows him smacking a golf ball that in the next frame seemingly strikes Clinton in the back, where she stumbles and falls down while boarding a plane. Trump retweeted the brief video on his official Twitter account early Sunday. It appears to be a doctored version of news footage from 2011 that shows the then Secretary of State falling after climbing the airplane stairs. The re-edited video appears to have superimposed images of a golf ball that is shown to be hitting Clinton. And in the retweet, it said, "Donald Trump's amazing swing, hashtag crooked Hillary." The video apparently was retweeted from an account that makes racial and anti-Semitic comments. Now, Trump has stepped up his criticism of Clinton since the Democratic presidential nominee reemerged in the spotlight to promote her new book about the 2016 presidential campaign. She's pretty much unsparing in her assessment of Trump, calling him a clear and present danger to the country and the world. That's a quote. Trump's tweeted video, though, is getting a lot of attention. His supporters, again, finding it hilarious, while others are complaining that the president retweeted a tweet showing violence against women. A CNN commentator blasted Trump over the tweet, saying, quote, "We cannot normalize this kind of behavior." And a commentator for the newspaper The Chicago Tribune writes, "Women in Congress should not work with Trump until he apologizes for the golf ball tweet." Others on social media are actually taking aim at Trump's daughter, Ivanka, who's promoting women at the UN General Assembly. Bottom line, though, regardless of where people stand on this issue, the bottom line is the president is again proving that he can control the news cycle with just a tweet. And by the way, at the television awards ceremony known as the Emmys, actor Alec Baldwin won for his portrayal of Trump on the late-night comedy variety show Saturday Night Live. And of course, he made a joke about sharing the award with Trump, who he joked never was able to win an Emmy during his time as a reality show star.
Many thanks, Lori. That is VOA's Lori London.
The United Nations General Assembly is meeting in New York, and VOA Africa is providing extensive coverage. We'll hear from world leaders about today's pressing issues. News of the latest developments, along with analysis. VOA Africa, your trusted source of news and information.
Tropical activity remaining robust out there, another Atlantic hurricane threatening the Caribbean islands, as did Hurricane Irma recently. The U.S. National Hurricane Center says that Hurricane Maria is expected to steadily gain power. VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with Dennis Felkin of the Hurricane Center.
Unfortunately, it is not done yet. We do expect it to strengthen and strengthen quite quickly, and it could be a major hurricane here during the next 48 hours.
Dennis, is it taking a similar track to that of Irma?
Well, unfortunately, it is impacting many of the islands, which were severely damaged by Irma just a week to 10 days ago. It's not an identical path, but it is still in the same general area. So this is not helping the situation down there at all.
The forecast track?
We do have hurricane warnings out for a number of the islands that were impacted by Irma, and that includes Guadalupe, Dominica, St. Kitts, Nevis, and Montserrat. Tropical storm warnings are also out for other parts of the Lesser Antilles and the Leeward Islands. And hurricane watches are out now for the U.S. and the British Virgin Islands and other islands in the northeastern Caribbean as well.
How likely and when might it hit impact the U.S. mainland?
It's far too early to tell what, if any, impacts will be felt on the U.S. mainland. Our five-day track still has it north of the Dominican Republic, so the United States mainland still has plenty of time to watch it.
A second storm, Hurricane Jose, still churns in the Atlantic. Where is it headed?
Jose is moving in a generally northerly track, and is what is very common with the hurricanes that get into the middle latitudes. The wind field is expanding. So even though the forecast for Jose is to remain well off the United States coastline, the wind field is so large that tropical storm watches had to be issued from New Jersey coastline all the way up to the Massachusetts coastline for the possibility of tropical storm force impacts during the next 48 hours.
Dennis Felkin of the U.S. National Hurricane Center speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
English poet Geoffrey Chaucer once said, "All good things must come to an end." And so it goes with NASA's Cassini mission, which provided a close-up look of Saturn, its moons, and famous rings over the last 13 years, came to a blazing end on September 11th. Like a scene from a Shakespeare tragedy, the space agency sent the spacecraft plunging through the ring planet's thick atmosphere to its total destruction. Earl Mays, the Cassini program manager, announced the end of the mission.
Just heard the signal from the spacecraft is gone, and within the next 45 seconds, so will be the spacecraft.
NASA says even as it was being sent on its fiery final journey, the spacecraft continued to collect and transmit valuable data back to Earth. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Well, in our music department report, a legend in her time and certainly now.
busted flat in Baton Rouge, waiting for a train, and I was feeling near as faded as my jeans. Bobby thumbed a diesel down just before it rained and rode us all the way to New Orleans. I pulled my harpoon out of my dirty red bandana. I was playing soft while Bobby sang the blues. Windshield wipers slapping time, I was holding.
Janis Joplin was an American singer and songwriter, one of the most popular female rock stars of her era. Her song, Me and Bobby McGee, reached number one on the Billboard Hot 100 in March of 1971. Born Janis Lynn Joplin in the U.S. city of Port Arthur, Texas in 1943, her music was blaring from radios everywhere just recently when rescue workers arrived in Port Arthur to help the people there. Their city and much of the rest of Southeast Texas had been ravaged by Hurricane Harvey. The song they heard most often was Joplin's 1968 hit, Peace of My Heart. Janis Joplin rose to fame during an appearance at the Monterey Pop Festival, where she was the lead singer of the little-known San Francisco psychedelic rock band Big Brother and the Holding Company. She went on to have tons of hits, including five singles on Billboard's Hot 100 chart. Ever controversial for her rebellious manner, Joplin styled herself partly after her female blues heroines and partly after the beat poets.
On the streets, looking good, and baby, deep down in your heart, I guess you know that it ain't right. Never, 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 never heal me when I cry. Then when I cry all the time, but each time I tell myself that I can't stand the pain. But when you hold me in your arms, I'm singing once again.
After releasing three albums, Janis Joplin died of a heroin overdose at the age of 27 in 1970. Highly respected for her charismatic performances, Joplin was posthumously inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1995. Audiences and critics alike referred to her stage presence as electric. Little Girl Blue was one of Janis Joplin's favorite songs. She recorded it in 1969. It had been written 35 years earlier by Richard Rodgers and Lawrence Hart, and in 2015 became a theme of Amy Berg's documentary about Joplin titled Janis, Little Girl Blue.
Sit there. Audio.
That's right, Janis Joplin. You know, I grew up in the town just a couple of miles away from where she grew up. Didn't know her personally, but man, she was popular in the so-called Golden Triangle of Texas. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you here. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Greg Burns, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday. Now a bit more from Janis Joplin.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Cameroon health officials are using new and upgraded tools to detect disease outbreaks at the earliest possible moment in order to respond effectively in a sophisticated exercise designed to test Cameroon's public health emergency management preparedness. The exercise began September 7th and ended September 15th. All of the tools and mechanisms that Cameroon, with U.S. assistance, has developed the last 2 years, such as improved laboratories, real-time surveillance, point-of-entry, medical countermeasures, risk communications, a new cadre of disease detectives, and an emergency operations center, were tested in responding to a simulated cholera outbreak originating in a small parish near Douala. Representatives from Cameroon's Ministry of Health, regional health centers, and laboratories, along with experts from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, as well as other partners, participated. This 11-day exercise allows participants and monitors to assess health officials' proficiency in tasks ranging from the collection of samples and the use of rapid diagnostic tests to the activization of Cameroon's Public Health Emergency Operations Center in Yaoundé, a new facility currently under construction. Senior public health officials' decision-making processes were also observed. This exercise, rooted in Cameroon's participation in the Global Health Security Agenda, or GHSA, is an important milestone that will test, document, and verify Cameroon's progress in meeting GHSA's important goals. GHSA was globally launched in February 2014 to improve the capabilities and reliabilities of nations worldwide to close gaps that allow disease outbreaks to emerge and spread. Cameroon was one of the earliest and most active members, which today counts more than 60 nations. Through GHSA, CDC Cameroon will receive more than $11 million during the next 3 years, in addition to the current ongoing investments of over $15 million through various activities from the U.S. Defense Threat Reduction Agency, U.S. Agency for International Development, and CDC. Cameroon joined the United States and 28 other nations as founding members of GHSA, a broad initiative to make the world safer and more secure from global health threats posed by infectious diseases. The United States is proud to work with Cameroon and other nations to help protect those most vulnerable to deadly disease.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.